unfortunately, if you ever got to court, then they start meaning how much you play Xbox, PlayStation, all that stuff.
Oh, well.
At this point, most of them don't say that. I didn't, but I do now.
Okay, so that extra credit assignment I gave a couple classes ago, 8 o'clock Monday morning is fine. I'll be accepting solutions until then. So those of you who ran out of time can take a crack at it then if you want. We have no class on Friday, holiday, so we have a long weekend.
Can we leave the test where you have it now? Like not next week, but the following Wednesday, that's where it's at now, right?
I don't even know where it is, wherever it is.
It's the 22nd.
Yeah.
So the idea is going to be to leave it there?
I think so. Yeah. We have.
See, that's what happens when I try to move things.
Well, it's
all right, so we're going to leave it there?
Yes.
Okay, that means I don't want a single complaint about how burnt out you are because you had all these other exams. But they'll probably bunch up. What?
They'll probably end up moving the one.
They'll move them. It always happens. That's why I just try to pick the dates at the beginning of the semester and stick to them. But maybe next time around, I'll think about as far as I know, was there a recitation last night?
I didn't get Monday.
It was Monday.
It wasn't Monday.
Oh, it was Monday, right. So did he go over the use of MATLAB for circuits and things?
He just kind of mentioned it at the end, like that he had one up there for us.
What, you worked homework or something?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
The test, or was it the exam?
No. Exam was last week, homework this week.
Okay. You'll probably have, on the final exam, you'll probably have a circuits problem that I'll ask you to do some analytic work on and then do some MATLAB on. The goal being to show you how you can use MATLAB to work with the circuits. So I wanted Todd to show you some of that as a recitation this week. He'll get to it. Okay, so today I want to talk about the design of IIR filters. And filter design is very important because it's a life skill that will get you through many things in life. Everything in life is a filter. For example, when your significant other is talking to you and you're only hearing, like, you know, every tenth word, that's a filter. When you search on the internet for something that is of interest to you, that's a filter. That's actually something called collaborative filtering. And then there, of course, the more obvious things like building electric circuits and things like that, or when you're in your graphics programs and you're smoothing your 3D images to get them look really cool and all that, those are filters. Those are multidimensional filters in many cases. So everything in life, and I really mean this, everything in life, so many engineering problems can be thought of as filters. And that's why I think understanding first order, second order systems, and then the higher order systems is important. So today I'm going to introduce you to several techniques to design IIR filters, and then I think next class we'll talk a little bit more about this, if I remember. And there's lots of good software out there, including stuff in MATLAB that I'll show you. There's lots of good applets and things. There's lots of good wiki pages. So this is a very, very mature, very well-studied area. And as I've mentioned several times throughout the semester, you can get code generators that will actually generate all the code for you. So if you want to implement a filter in a particular device, like a PIC or a DSP or something, you can get code generators to do all that for you. So the emphasis really then becomes the design of the filter to do what you need. So let's talk about difference equations. So this lecture is going to be all digital, though a lot of what we talk about will have corresponding things on the analog side. So recall our expression for a linear constant coefficient difference equation. Y of n plus a1, y of n minus 1 plus a2, y of n minus 2, and so forth, is equal to b0 times x of n plus b1 x of n minus 1, and so forth. We can write this equation succinctly using summations. So we can write that y of n is equal to minus the sum from k equals 1 to n of a sub k y of n minus k, plus the sum from L equals 0 to M of B sub L, X sub N minus L. And that's just a shorthand notation for the above equation. We can draw a signal flow graph of this equation using this implementation that I showed here. So let's talk about how we get that implementation.
I lost my pointer.
Okay.
On the chair.
I really thought somebody.
Somebody's still like a broken meter state.
Some very cool person that wanted to make this lecture.
I'll just start bringing my laser pointer if I have to.
I'll start bringing my laser.
So, we have x of n, and we have this term b0 times x of n. We have this term b1 times x of n minus 1. Now, in the z domain, when I delay a signal by one sample, what's that correspond to with the z transport?
One over z.
Multiplication by z minus 1, right? Because if I have a system y of n is equal to x of n minus 1, if I take the z transform of this, what's the z transform of x of n minus 1 going to be?
X of z.
So it's going to, if you remember, this is going to be z minus 1 x of z. Now, this is, if you think about this in terms of differential equations, if I take the Laplace transform of this, what do I have on the right hand side?
1 over n, or sx of s.
Sx of s. So it's completely analogous to the Laplace transform. And we actually proved this property a while ago. So what I'm going to do for this term is I'm going to take x of n, I'm going to multiply, I'm going to delay it by one sample using this block, this delay element, which we label as z minus 1. And then I'm going to multiply it by b1 and sum it. And I'll do the same for the term, for the b2 term, only now I can delay once more. So out here, I've got x of n minus 1, x of n minus 2, and so forth. So this structure gives me this part of the equation. So then I'll take that signal, and we have y of n is equal to that. So I'll have a summer here, and we'll feed in this summation. But now I also have to construct these terms. So I'll take y of n, and I'll delay it by 1, and get y of n minus 1. And then I'll multiply it by a minus a1, and sum it. And then I'll do the same thing for y of n minus 2, minus a2, and I'll sum it. So this structure represents that equation. And this structure is known as the direct form 1 implementation of that difference equation. Okay, so that's fairly straightforward, and you can actually write computer code to implement this. Wouldn't be too difficult using some memory elements and using what we call a delay line. But we can actually do a little bit better than that. One of the more elementary aspects of the field of digital signal processing is to develop more efficient implementations of digital filters, as well as improve their ability to produce accurate results with less numerical precision. And generally speaking, we can always make an algorithm run faster if we're willing to use more memory. There's always a trade-off between speed and memory. And that's why, for example, your laptops keep getting bigger and bigger memories, because manufacturers like to do more and more stuff in memory to make things run faster. and you can actually show with a lot of the algorithms we talk about that we can make them more efficient, such as FFTs, if we use more memory. But another very important point is this issue about numerical precision. The more processing steps you go through, particularly the more multiplies and accumulates you do, what's going to happen to the accuracy of your overall result?
It's going to get more accurate, isn't it? Oh, wait, the more multiplies.
The more multiplies and accumulates you do.
I thought you meant the more data points you have.
Rather
of uncertainty.
So we've all done something simple, like take, one divided by three. And when you do this on a computer, what happens? Well, you get something that's very, very close.
Zero?
Not good. If you're doing something. And I think that I told a story earlier in the semester about with the original digital audio tape players, we used to use a sample frequency of 8 kilohertz, which if you do this in the time domain, this is the amount of time between samples. And in the early implementations of digital audio tape players, if you ran the machine for a long period of time, the errors in the computations would accumulate to the point where at the end of a 2-hour tape, you'd be off. You could look at a bunch of machines and they'd be off by 1 or 2 seconds because of the random round-off error type behavior. And if you've done this, if you've ever done this in software, like even in MATLAB, if you take a number that's an approximation and you add it up many, many times, eventually you'll see the result will start to diverge. Even when you're using 4-byte floating point numbers, 32-bit numbers, you can accumulate a significant amount of error. And think about what's happening in a filter like this. You have a feedback loop. So every time you do a calculation, that gets fed back, and it continues to iterate on that calculation. So the round-off errors can actually accumulate pretty significantly. Further, you may not want to use a full 32-bit floating point representation to implement these things. Many of you now work with fixed point devices like PICs or DSPs in some cases. If you want to build really low power applications like these kinds of devices, you're not going to be using floating point DSPs. You're going to do everything in fixed point arithmetic because it takes a lot less power. So when you want to do this kind of thing with fixed point arithmetic, now you've got problems because the filter coefficients will be floating point numbers less than one typically. The signal sample will be 16-bit numbers. You've got to somehow multiply a floating point number by an integer number and get back an integer number and do all that in integer arithmetic. So people have studied this problem for many, many years and developed very good guidelines for how to implement what we call pseudo-floating point math, so that you can do what appear to be floating point calculations in fixed point arithmetic. And some of you, if you go on to building devices and programming devices to do these kinds of things for real-time systems, you get exposed to this, because most low-cost real-time systems are implemented in fixed point arithmetic, even though you'll be implementing what appear to be floating point computations. So there's lots of reasons why we would like to alter that filter structure. And, in fact, a more efficient implementation of the same structure is shown here. This filter has the same transfer function as the previous filter, but it shares the delay element between feed-forward path and the feedback path. The feed-forward path we often call the moving average or the finite impulse response portion, and the feedback path we often call the autoregressive or the IIR, or infinite impulse response portion of the filter. Now the advantage of this filter is that it uses less memory. What is the principal advantage of using less memory in a real system?
Lower cost, lower power.
Lower power, lower cost, frees up that memory to do other things. So for many years, cell phones had very small amounts of memory and could barely do the coding algorithms, let alone things like MP3 players. Now, of course, you know, with MP3 players and all that, they've gotten to where they have a lot more memory. But the very first implementations of things like voice dialing, we were actually doing those. We had computer programs that were doing those in megabytes of memory, and we actually reduced those to algorithms that ran in 12,000 bytes of memory and 16,000 bytes of memory.
So that's why they sucked.
Well, they were actually pretty good.
Well, for 12,000 bytes of memory, it was pretty good.
And the more memory, now that we've got megabytes of memory on these machines, we can do better. However, the other reason you're always worried about memory is algorithms generally need high-speed memory. They can't use slow-speed cache memory, slow-speed like DRAM type stuff. You would need to be either onboard or really fast memory, and the fast memory is what's expensive. So there's a whole area of digital signal processing devoted to efficient implementations of these algorithms. Now we can talk about two principal types of filters, finite impulse response and infinite impulse response. Consider a filter with only feed-forward components. The transfer function of this filter, we just went through it, is essentially h of z is equal to the sum from l equals 0 to m of d sub l times z to the minus l. If you apply an impulse to this system, what will you get out? You'll get out the impulse response, but will the impulse response, you can actually tell me exactly what you're going to get out for this.
Don't you get an infinite number?
Do you get an infinite number? It's finite, right? Because of course the slide says it's finite. If you have a difference equation, so if I hit this with an impulse, what's going to happen at time zero?
It's going to have the infinite response.
No, it's going to have the impulse times.
So x of n is delta of n. This means that x equals zero. What's the output going to be?
B zero.
B zero, right? What's the input at x equals 1? When n is equal to 1, if the input is a delta function, the value of x is
0.
0, right?
The output of the signal is b1.
Right, so y of 1 is going to be b0 times 0 plus b1 times 1.
And then nothing else happens.
Which is b1, and then it's just going to be 0. So what happens if I make this d2 x of n minus 2?
You have an impulse response that corresponds to b2.
y2 is b2.
y2 is b2, and then it's
0. Zero is.
So, if I hit this thing with an impulse response, what am I going to get out? I'm basically going to get out, for the impulse response, these coefficients.
So, is this the impulse response, like, over so many points, or is this, like, the impulse response for so many impulse responses at so many points?
This is a system.
It's multiple impulse is being provided as a way of doing it, right?
Like for every pulse in, you get 3 pulses out.
This is a system, right?
Yes.
So when I apply delta of n here, what do I get out?
the impulse response.
You get the convolution of X and the nature.
Which for this particular filter is?
Is that different equation?
This is V0, X of n, V1, X of n minus 1, V2, X of n minus 2. It's this precisely what we just calculated. So what I'll get out here, Y of n, is going to be V0 times delta of n plus V1 times delta of n minus 1 plus V2 delta of n minus 2, and so forth. So I think that's what you're trying to say. When you said, I realize you said multiple impulses.
Yeah.
Right. So this is just a signal that has a value of V0 at time 0, has a value of V1 at time 1, has a value of V2 at time 2, and so on.
Okay.
So that was sort of an easy question, though on exams they never seem to be easy. When I apply an impulse to this, what I get out is essentially the filter coefficients. But you'll notice that since M is finite, capital M, this filter has a finite number of non-zero terms, and therefore the filter is referred to as a finite impulse response filter. Now, another interesting consequence of that is if I take a system like this, or I take an impulse response like this, it's only going to have zeros in the spectrum. It will not have poles, because there's no denominator term in the transfer function. So finite impulse response filters only have zeros. They do not have poles. And we'll make use of that fact later when we talk about filter design. But before we do that, let's talk about the sort of the converse. Let's talk about a filter with only the feedback portion. The transfer function for this looks something like this. We have the previous samples of the output added to the input. The transfer function looks like this, and this is an all-pole filter with an infinite impulse response. Why?
Because the last output is always being fed back in. With the finite impulse response, we've only got one input, but with this, we've always got a new input.
It just kind of rings.
Yeah.
Now, let's sort of prove that mathematically. If I just had one coefficient here, 1 over 1 plus A1Z minus 1, what does the inverse Z transform correspond to for that?
A delay of 1-ish?
So if H of Z is equal to 1 over 1 plus A1Z minus 1, what does H of N equal?
1 over 1 plus A1Z, or ANZ.
What's the equivalent of this for analog systems? If I had H of S with 1 over S minus A, what does H of T correspond to?
It's an exponential.
This kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. What's the corresponding thing here?
It's also going to be an exponential.
Right. A1 to the n, U of n. This is the equivalent of an exponential for discrete time. So, how long does this impulse response last?
Forever?
Forever, because it's just a decaying exponential. So anytime you have one pole in the system, and it only takes one pole, then you have an infinite impulse response. So, design of digital filters using analog prototypes. Analog filter design was developed in the mid-1900s. As digital signal processing developed, it seemed reasonable to leverage this existing knowledge in analog filter design. Our strategy will be to design the filter in the analog domain and then transform the filter into the digital domain. This is one of the basic ways we do filter design We can derive this transformation by recalling the relationship between the Laplace transform and the Z transform. You recall that the Z transform was just the Laplace transform with this relationship of Z is equal to e to the st. We essentially define the variable Z to be equal to that. And if you invert this equation, you can write that S is equal to 1 over T times the log of Z. Now, the log of Z is a little bit unsettling because Z is a complex number, and your calculators in the olden days used to not like take logs of Z. I imagine your calculators now that can actually take logs of complex numbers. But nevertheless, we can actually approximate this logarithm using this transformation, 2 over t times z minus 1 over z plus 1. You can derive that a number of ways, but it's essentially like a Taylor series approximation of the logarithm. And we often like to write it, multiplying by z minus 1, to write it in this form. This transformation is known as a bilinear transform, and we'll see why in a moment. And this transformation is actually used in a number of areas of science. After I learned this in my graduate studies, it was interesting to me how many different places I saw this kind of a transformation being used. You'll often see this in electromagnetics, for example, when you're trying to solve some of these really complex surface problems and you want to map them into simpler surfaces. It maps the left half S-plane into the interior unit circle of the Z-plane, which is a desirable property, because that means that if the filter is stable, if the analog filter is stable, and then we map it into the Z domain, we will also get a stable digital filter. There are mappings which do not preserve stability, and that's a real problem, because then you can end up with an unstable filter. But this transformation maps the S-plane. So it maps the entire S-plane into the inside of the unit circle. Now that's the good news. The bad news is, to achieve this kind of a mapping, it has to warp what we call warp the frequency axis. What that means is that the frequencies, if this filter is designed to have a cutoff frequency of 1 kHz, when you map it to the Z domain and you look at the frequency response of that filter, the cutoff frequency is no longer 1 kHz. So the analog filter must be pre-warped so that it lands at the proper frequency in the Z plane, and we can actually derive the properties of that mapping. If we let S be equal to sigma plus j omega and Z be equal to a magnitude R times e to the j omega, we can set up an equation that says sigma plus j omega is equal to 2 over t times 1 minus r e to the minus j omega over 1 plus r e to the plus j omega, just making these substitutions into this equation. Now, you can take those, you can solve, in those equations, you can solve for sigma and you can solve for omega by equating the real and imaginary parts of those equations. And when you do that, you get these expressions. Now, we can focus for the moment on this equation and set R equal to 1, because we want to look at the frequency response along the unit circle. When we set R equal to 1, this equation simplifies to 2 over t times sine omega over 1 plus cosine omega. And if you think about that long enough, you can actually show that that's equal to the tangent of omega over 2. Therefore, omega, we can invert this and write that omega is equal to 2 times the inverse tangent of this omega t over 2. Now, there's two omegas here, so we need to explain what that means. This suggests a design strategy. If I plot this function, it looks something like this. Omega is our analog frequency, and this other omega is our discrete time frequency. So this suggests a design strategy where we establish requirements of a filter
for example, we want the filter to cut off, to have a cutoff frequency of 1 kilohertz, we pre-warp the filter by computing the analog frequency that corresponds to this discrete frequency using this mapping. We design the filter using this frequency, which is going to be off, and I'll show you an example in a moment. This will be a little bit larger than 1 kilohertz, be like 1.1 kilohertz or 1.01 kilohertz. We then design the filter for this frequency, and then we derive the digital filter from the analog filter, and then when we plot the frequency response of the digital filter, it will fall, its cutoff frequency will be exactly at 1 kilohertz.
So why does the frequency response to the digital filter differ from the frequency?
Because where is frequency response in the analog domain?
Like, I mean, it's
along the J-omega axis, right? Okay. And we've learned, you know, we've analyzed some cases where we show that frequency response is sort of related to the distance from the poles and all that kind of stuff, right? And we talked about if I move the pole this way, the frequency response changes. If I move the pole this way, the frequency response changes. If I move this way, the bandwidth changes. If I move this way, the frequency changes. The distance of the poles from this axis are very crucial to the shape of the frequency response. But when I map this into here, fortunately, the J omega axis actually maps to the unit circle. Mm-hmm. But we're taking this infinite plane and kind of compressing it into the circle.
Okay, so
the pole location sort of shift, and the overall frequency response shift, it kind of deforms a little bit. Okay. And therefore, we can offset some of that by doing this warping strategy. Now, there's a whole body of literature on how you do digital filter design. I'm just showing this one case to highlight the fact that the shape of the filter changes a little bit, and we have to offset for that. So let's look at an example to make this a little more concrete. If you remember, with our Laplace transforms, we defined this polynomial as a second order Butterworth filter. And you may also remember, we talked about Butterworth filters as being filters that are very flat in the pass band and then have ripple in the stop band. So let's let our sample frequency be 5 hertz and our desired low pass cutoff frequency to be 0.318 hertz, which actually corresponds to 2 radians per second. Our desired digital cutoff frequency then for the filter is going to be this omega scaled by the sample frequency, so it's going to be 0.4 radians. So we want the digital filter to have a 3 dB point at 4 radians, 0.4 radians. Now, if we just go ahead and design this polynomial at 0.4 radians, what? You're shaking your head.
This is just...
You're lost.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go ahead. Not a problem.
It's like math blew up all over the
board. No, the problem is you don't have this, a good intuition yet for the discrete time stuff. Okay, so let's just take it one step at a time. This is a second order polynomial, right? Okay. And you all know how to get the frequency response to this.
Like factor in the denominator and get the poles?
I'm like mean? Just going to MATLAB and plot it. Okay, so what's the general shape of that frequency response?
It's going to have 2 poles.
Second order polynomial. It's most likely going to be low pass. It could be band pass, but band pass and low pass are really the same thing. It's going to have a... It's either going to look like this, or it's going to look like this, but it's generally going to have kind of a low pass. You know, this you can actually think about a low pass filter as a band pass filter at a frequency of 0. So essentially, they're both band pass filters. Now, we want to build a digital filter. That means one of these guys, one of these difference equations, based on this analog filter. Now, why you want to do that, you guys aren't old enough to appreciate that, because by the time you were born, filter design was dead and buried. Mature, everyone knew how to do it. But, and we'll get to that point in a moment. You've got, at the end of this lecture, you've got a function that'll do everything for you. You don't have to worry about anything. But I want you to have some appreciation for that. So, we've got this analog filter. We want it to have a cutoff frequency in the digital domain of 0.4 radians, which corresponds to this 0.318 hertz, but because we have a sample frequency of 5 hertz, we have to take this frequency and sort of normalize it relative to the sample frequency. So this 2 radians per second is the radian frequency in the analog domain. Okay, that just corresponds to 0.318 hertz, multiply this by 2 pi. So if our sample frequency is 5 hertz, and we want the cutoff frequency to be 2 radians per second, what does that correspond to in the digital domain? Well, we have to divide by the sample frequency, right? Because everything in the digital domain is normalized by the sample frequency. So what we really want is a filter that has a cutoff frequency of 0.4 radians, two radians per second times, or divided by the sample frequency, times 1 over the sample frequency. So this is what we want. Remember, the digital domain, in the digital domain, everything goes between pi and minus pi, right? So this 0.4 radians per second is right here, from 0 to pi. This is actually minus pi to pi. This is where we want the filter cutoff frequency to be, so that at a 5 hertz sample frequency, we're getting a cutoff at 0.318 hertz. Okay? Now there's an interesting consequence of this. I could design the filter for its 10 hertz sample frequency and twice that, you know, 0.8 cutoff frequency, and it would be the same thing. The digital filters are always with respect to the sample frequency, so you normalize out the sample frequency. Okay, so does everybody, are you with me up to here? This is what it needs to be in the digital domain, so that when you implement this system at a 5 hertz sample frequency, you get this cutoff frequency. Now the problem is, if we design this filter directly for this cutoff frequency, and then we transform this filter into the digital domain using the bilinear transform, the frequency response is not going to be here, it's going to shift a little.
Not by much, though.
Not by much, but
just a little.
So we need to compute the corresponding frequency here so that this ends up being in the right place, 0.4 radians. So if we use our bilinear transform equation, we can compute omega sub c as 2 over t times the tangent of omega c over 2. That gives us 2.027 radians per second instead of 2 radians per second. If we design this filter at 2.027 radians per second, then when we do the digital filter, it will land at the right cutoff frequency. That's the process of what we call free warping. So we do that, and we can actually convert this to, if you're more comfortable in hertz, we can convert this to hertz just by dividing by 2 pi. So you see, we're designing the filter at 0.323 hertz instead of 0.318 hertz. For some reason, it's easier to think of hertz, right? Okay, so then we can derive this h of s so that we achieve this cutoff frequency. And That's just a matter of plugging in four omega, in this case, plugging in this omega sub c into here. And let's see. Yeah, this is the square. This is actually the square of this,
yes.
Which. This is a corresponding analog filter that has a cutoff frequency at this frequency, and we haven't gone in detail in this course about how to design these. But in a moment, you'll see the math. You can do all this in MATLAB. But just take it on faith that this polynomial has a cutoff frequency at this frequency.
So that you can plug in frequency instead of radians in that.
That's what was stumping me. This, I think this specification is in.
Actually, the F sub C.
Yeah, it should be F sub C, and that's why I got a little confused.
So you'd be in the frequency domain, or the Hertz frequency domain.
I think it should be radian, but anyway, look. We'll see in a moment. We can check all this in MATLAB. So then what you do is you take this filter, this H of S, and you plug in S is equal to this 2Z minus 1 over Z plus 1, and that gives you this digital filter. And my argument is that this digital filter, if you plot the frequency response of this digital filter, you'll end up with this, and you'll end up with a cutoff frequency exactly at the 0.4 radians per second that we wanted. Whereas if you were to design the filter without the warping, you'll get this, and this filter will have a cutoff frequency slightly above 0.4 radians. So this is sort of a manual demonstration of how you can design a digital filter at the right frequency by starting with an analog filter and doing the necessary transformations to make the cutoff frequency fall in the right place. Now, fortunately, MATLAB makes a lot of this really nice and easy. So, for the first example, let's let our sample frequency be 5 Hertz, our cutoff frequency be 0.318 Hertz, and our desired digital cutoff frequency, as we said, is 2 radians per second divided by 5 Hertz, or 0.4 radians. So here we have a MATLAB function to create the Butterworth polynomial. Here we have a function that's going to give us the transfer function. Here we set the desired cutoff frequency to 2 radians per second. And then here we do the bilinear transformation. And then here we actually we get the filter. This does the filter design in the analog domain. So this gives us the analog filter, and then this gives us the digital filter by transforming this analog filter into the digital filter. And this is the resulting digital filter. And those coefficients should match what we showed on the previous page.
What are those, do you know what those commands stand for, like ZP to TF?
This is the,
zeros, poles, and what's ZP?
Yeah, this is exactly. This is zero and poles to transfer function.
Zeros and poles.
So this thing apparently gives you the zeros and poles of the function and the orders. and then this thing converts those to polynomials.
LP to LP.
And then this LP to LP converts the. This is doing the transformation, the warping, essentially. And then this function does the conversion. This is a function in S, and this does the conversion into a function in Z.
And those are our coefficients.
And then those are coefficients.
Okay.
And this is the frequency response that corresponds to that. Now, let me demonstrate this a similar process for the Chebyshev type 1. So let our sample frequency be 5 Hz, same cutoff frequency. Our passband ripple is 3 dB. But now we're going to do a high pass filter. So we set up the number of poles, we set up the parameters of the filter, but here we can invoke a function that does everything in one shot. It takes the specifications in the digital domain and it computes, it does all of this optimization for you. And in fact, in that first example, there's a command called butter, which would actually do all of this in one command. So I just wanted to show you the steps in that command, but were you to do this, the beauty of these tools is that they can do all this warping and all this optimization for you automatically. Whereas here, in this example, we're designing the filter directly in the digital domain using a function that's provided. So fortunately, a lot of this has been automated. What hasn't been automated, though, is the knowledge of which is the best type of filter to use for the application. That's what you as the designer are going to do. Now these tools have gotten sufficiently advanced so that you can actually draw the frequency response and have it then implement that drawing either digitally or analog and do all the optimizations for you and spit out the DSP code or the microprocessor code or the PIC code or whatever else you want. And that's essentially what was being developed in the early 1980s. And I was fortunate enough to be at Texas Instruments at the time while this was being developed, so it was kind of fun to be involved in some of that. And by the late 80s, this was all done, it was all automated. And in fact, now you can even do things like you can run this into silicon compilers and they can actually spit out custom silicon implementations of this thing. You can go into FPGAs and whatever, all this kind of stuff. But again, the thing they can't tell you is what is the best frequency response for your application. That's what you as the designer are going to have to figure out. And that's going to be a matter of balancing performance and cost and speed and power and all those good things. And if you're working at super high frequencies, in audio band ranges, this is all kind of mature. But if you're working in the gigahertz range on some really advanced routing equipment and you need filters that are running in the gigahertz range, then you're going to worry about these kinds of computations and all the little details. Because at those speeds, you're pushing the limits of what we can do in silicon. And then from time to time, you'll actually implement these kinds of filters in analog components. We used early on, I was working with a company that had developed filter modules for fluids. They actually had little fluidic devices that you could build filters out of by just cascading these things together. And they had logic gates and everything. It was really cool. You could actually build circuits out of these little fluids, and they were just little devices that had like a pipe, like a pipe connection on one side and a pipe connection on the other side, and all that stuff. So you can actually do this kind of thing in analog. They have also components for motors that allow you to put various filtering controls on motors, and they have all sorts of little mechanical parts that you can snap together, kind of like Legos, to achieve these kinds of responses and things. So what we've done today is to introduce you to realizations of difference equations using signal flow graphs. We've introduced the concept of a finite impulse response and an infinite impulse response filter. We've discussed a method for transforming an analog filter to a digital filter that preserves the stability of the filter. We described a method to pre-warp the frequency axis so that the analog filter results in the digital filter at the right frequency. And then we demonstrated this design process using Butterworth and Chebyshev prototypes and showed you how to do this in MATLAB. So you actually have a lot of tools at your disposal now to design filters. So, have a good Easter weekend, and I will see you on Monday.